Raidieraksts drošinātājs.
I saw those three flags on your Twitter account, the flag of the United States, also the flag of Lithuania and Ukraine. So I have a very specific question. Are you American, Lithuanian or Ukrainian?
Well, very technically, I am Lithuanian-American. However, my great-grandmother was born in Dnipro, so there is a little bit of Ukrainian blood, we think, in there somewhere. So I guess a little bit of everything, but I am an American citizen with Lithuanian roots, yes.
So you were born in the United States, yes?
Actually, I was not. I was born in Berlin, oh. Funnily enough, but I was raised in the U.S. I am everywhere. So.
Yeah. It sounds like that, yeah. Well, speaking about Lithuania, you can probably, in that way, be proud that country, our neighbors, Latvian neighbors, Lithuania, they're helping a lot to Ukraine right now.
Oh yeah, I'm very proud. And I think that it's an incredible thing to be basically the leaders of the charge in terms of helping Ukraine with defense and everything else. I mean, they really are very good friends of Ukraine. And I think that is rooted in an understanding of what, you know, Russian occupation is like. So I think they really take it seriously and they take it to heart that Ukraine needs all the help that it can get. So yes, incredibly proud.
Yeah, and I definitely need to ask also about, of course, what is going on in the United States, since you're an American, considering what is happening there in the Congress. What do you think about all those things that they are still trying to solve, all the political problems there, and many weeks, many months, they're still trying to do this, but no results so far. How do you see all this process in the U.S.?
Well, frankly, as an American, I'm embarrassed of some of the behavior of the Republican Party. It's hard to watch, especially also with like the commentary that I get on my Twitter, you know, and all kinds of, it's a lot of, I think, what is happening in Congress is rooted in ignorance and also a failure to understand that if, you know, Ukraine isn't helped with everything that it needs in terms of arms, you know, and if God forbid the worst happens, Russia will not stop at Ukraine. It will try to take the rest of Europe. I think it's wrong to underestimate Russia. And I also think that it is irresponsible for members of U.S. Congress to turn a blind eye to Ukraine and try to use other excuses of things like America first, when they weren't even putting America first before the war, to justify their beliefs. It's very difficult to watch right now. We've always fought against communism and against those trying to take away the freedom of others. You know, it's what America does. So to have, you know, important members of Congress have these strange opinions and, you know, veritably turn their back on a fight for freedom and democracy, it's wrong. It feels like I'm living in an alternate universe almost.
And, well, since the elections is coming, and so if I may ask, what do you think about the two potential presidential candidates?
If I'm going to be completely honest, neither one of them is great. I think one is obviously worse than the other. I believe that, you know, I would not vote for Donald Trump. That's just a personal opinion, because I do not think he understands the seriousness of what Russia is doing, or just doesn't care. And that's a problem for me. So unfortunately, it's another situation of picking the lesser of two evils. So it's a hard time to be an American right now. I'm still very proud to be American always. I'm proud of my country and I'm proud of the ideals that it has stood for. I just don't really understand what is happening to it right now.
Yeah, well, speaking about Ukraine, in which part in Ukraine do you live right now?
Currently, I'm in the east. I tend to bounce around a lot because if I'm, you know, teaching, then I will go wherever I am needed to teach tactical medicine or help instruct with other instructors. So, but currently I'm in the eastern part of the country.
How and why did you decide to go to Ukraine? I guess it's also somehow connected with this, that you have a connection with Lithuania and also some little connection in Ukraine again as well.
Well, and that's all part of it. To be honest, it's part of it is, yes, the generational trauma. My grandmother is a World War II refugee. And I grew up listening to stories about what happened in the invasion of Lithuania and things like that. So, you know, obviously, and I'm a political scientist by education, so my papers and everything, I wrote a lot of them on Russian imperialistic tactics and Lithuania's fight for freedom. But even as an American, it's right to fight for the freedom of others and also fight for their democracy. Every country has a right not to be invaded and have somebody try to take, you know, their land away from them that doesn't belong to them. So for me, it's a merging of every identity from being Lithuanian, but to also being American and doing what's right. So that's all of those things made my decision for me to start working first in bringing in humanitarian and non-lethal military aid. I did that for the first year and a half of the war, and then I transitioned to my medic studies during that time as well.
And how long have you been in Ukraine since the 22?
I started coming in September of 22, yes. I was in Kharkiv during the counteroffensive. It was then on and off, back and forth until February of last year, and then I came in and I've been here pretty much since then. And I went home only twice last year.
You said that you, in the first months, you delivered aid.
Yes.
In Ukraine. Yeah, well, you can tell how that went. Where did you go? To what places? What kind of aid? And
yeah. Oh, definitely. So most of it was non-lethal military aid that we delivered. As Blue Yellow USA, I was a managing director of Blue Yellow USA. Mm. And essentially we would go pretty much everywhere. We helped many units. I have been to the front many times. We were usually mostly in the east and the south between Kherson and places like Izum, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, pretty much most of those places, Kharkiv as well. And so, I mean, we really didn't discriminate. We were all over the front. But yeah, we helped a lot of units. So, and Blue Yellow USA continues to do so even after I've left. They're still, you know, they are doing a lot. They have an IFAC fundraiser going on right now. So they're still very active.
And so have you maybe many Americans there in Ukraine, or some of them?
Yeah, I've met some. Most of them are fighters. I've met some in the NGO sphere, but all very good people that are very focused on helping Ukraine win. So yeah.
What do your relatives and friends think about going to Ukraine, that you are in Ukraine?
Well, obviously, you know, they worry, just like anybody would. And I think they also know that, like, this is the right thing to do for me, and that, you know, they understand why I do it. But, you know, naturally they worry. So, but they agree that it's, you know, fighting for Ukraine is the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Returning back to you a little bit to United States, how do you see opinion of the society right now? Everyone's talking about more and more about war fatigue. How do you see it? Is it a problem right now also in the U.S. and becoming more and more problem when the elections also is coming and it's getting bigger maybe?
I think war fatigue has been an issue for some time now, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I still believe that the majority of people in the United States support helping Ukraine, which is good. But, you know, obviously, everybody is, it wears you down. I mean, we're in, you know, year two already of the full-scale invasion, but it's been 10 years. But it's natural that people are going to get tired of it, or not tired of it per se, but it will start wearing people down. So, I mean, the best thing that we can do is continue to shed light on what's happening here. You know, there were more bombings in Sumy yesterday. Like, this is just, we have to keep it at the forefront of people's attention, because mainstream media is already too quiet about a lot of it. So it's up to us that are on Twitter, Instagram, and all of those things to continue to spread these things and make them go viral, to let them know that the war is still very much going on here and we still need a lot of help.
And you're pretty active on the Twitter. What kind of feedback do you get maybe, or what do you see, what people are talking about there? Yeah,
it's 50-50. You know, obviously I get a lot of trolls and bots that comment horrible things. But that's, you know, unfortunately, when you're that visible, you're going to get those comments. And most of them, I think the part that shocks me is how much ignorance there is, and how ready they are to believe what they read on the internet that is propaganda. So, I mean, needing to fight disinformation is still very real, especially on the internet. And there are a lot of people that are, you know, pro-Ukrainian in the Twitter community that are doing that daily. And I think that's extremely important. And then on the other hand, we get a lot of Americans that are, you know, very supportive. I share consistently that I'm an American that's helping in Ukraine, and I believe that it is the right thing to do, and especially as an American. So I'll get, you know, supporting comments from other Americans, but at the same time, I will get comments from, you know, MAGA crowd or other people that tell me that I'm a terrible person and that, you know, all I do is help Nazis, which is ridiculous because the president of Ukraine is Jewish. So I don't, whatever, you know, as I'm sure you've seen the insanity on Twitter. I just ignore those comments because I know that it's not coming from a place of rational thought. So that's, it's 50-50, I would say. It's 50 in favor and still supporting. And then we have, we're getting, unfortunately, louder voices that are problematic. Yeah. So
it was, I guess, some Ukrainian politician or I don't remember really, but it doesn't matter if we, I don't know, even if we are Nazis or fascists or whatever, Russia needs to leave us alone and decide, and Ukrainians decide what they will do in Ukraine and whether they are fascists or not a fascist. That's not a reason to invade, you know. So, yeah.
I mean, the problem is like the logic or the lack of logic that Russia employs in their strange propaganda. And some of it is just absolutely laughable in some ways. But the problem is there are people out there that take it seriously that do not understand history and don't do the research and then don't read. And so they go, oh my God, this has to be true. And my favorite is when Americans, like they sit there and they go, well, we heard Ukraine is full of Nazis. I was like, okay, talk to me about the neo-Nazis that are in America. Are you going to get mad about them too? Or is this just because it's Ukraine? Like that's, I tend to try to fight logic with logic. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, turning to your work in Ukraine, tell me please, what exactly do you do in Ukraine and why do you do it? I know it's from your Twitter. I know it's all connected to the medical side.
Yes. Currently I am helping. I'm a fully certified medic. I am helping teach tactical medicine. That is currently what I am doing in Ukraine.
What do you did in the United States? Do you have medical education or you worked in some other profession? I don't know.
I was working in a different profession. I have done all of my medic certifications and studies in Ukraine. That is, I was working in a much different sphere, as were a lot of people. That I was working in private finance at that time.
And why do you choose specifically this medical front?
There aren't enough medics in Ukraine. There aren't. And I knew that it was something that I could do. And I knew that I could do it with the right education. And I have been very lucky to have excellent instructors, excellent teachers that have mentored me along the way. And I've worked very, very hard. I have definitely spent countless hours working as hard as possible. And just like a lot of my friends out here who also became medics as well, you know, there are a lot of medics out here who didn't start that way and all received the same training and the same certifications. So, you know, you have to, it's war. You do what you have to do in order to help as much as you can.
And how long did it take to learn this, to get this those certificates?
About 8 months.
And when did you started learning?
I started last September.
Last September. So it's for how long are you teaching others right now?
Well, that's about 7 months. I started teaching co-teaching in December.
Can you describe your day, how it starts and how it ends, how busy it is? I guess every day is different, maybe.
Yeah, pretty much every day is different. When I'm not teaching, I'm usually coordinating in logistics, helping get some supplies that I may have gotten out to other people at the front, answering emails, answering questions, you know, usually dealing with Twitter, you know. So I do a lot of teaching. I help teach with several different tech med courses. And that's always, it's a passion, really. I enjoy it very much. So it's good too, because we need to help get more people, especially soldiers, trained up in tactical medicine. So, you know, we do our best, and I have excellent co-teacher friends that I work with. So that's usually, you know, every day is different, honestly.
Who are those people usually do you train in tactical medicine? It's usually military personnel or also?
Yes. Yeah. 90% of the time it's soldiers. We do have some civilians that come through, but 90% of the time it's soldiers. Yeah.
So you do this training. Where does the training take place? It's near or far from the front, or it differs? Yeah.
It's all over the place. You know, obviously I'm not going to give specifics because of OPSEC, but it's all over the place. It can be in the West, it can be in the East. The main thing is, you know, being mobile if you can be, because not every unit can come to you. So like that's, you know, if you can do it. Usually I end up teaching in static locations, but yeah, so it just depends.
You yourself have stated that this tactical medicine teaching has changed your life. Why and how?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's because you are teaching someone to help save their own life or someone else's life. Mm. And especially on the battlefield where that matters the most, it's a life-changing experience to watch people, you know, gain an understanding of how to do it and then come to you later and say, thank you for teaching me this because it helped me when I was in that, you know, situation. So that's how it's changed my life, because you become a force multiplier. And in a sense, if you really think about it, teaching tactical medicine helps save many lives, not just one or, you know, anybody else, because then they take that knowledge and they can help teach someone else or help them understand how to properly apply a tourniquet. These things, teaching these things is vital for survival. So that's, for me, that's why it's changed my life.
And so you get the feedback from the soldiers that, I don't know, maybe some soldiers wrote you specifically about some, I don't know, events that your training helped him save his partner's life, for example, or something like that.
We get indirect feedback about that. You know, I hear about it from other instructors, you know, you know, part of our classes, you know, they'll tell me that, you know, they get stories like that. And, you know, so to be part of that experience is really important too. And just also like when they come to you and say, thank you for teaching me this, like, and they mean it sincerely, it's a big deal. You know, I mean, it's something, we'll put it that way. I do get some people that will tell me indirectly, hey, you know, this person thinks you're a good instructor and things like that. And that kind of helps validate the work that I help do with other instructors, you know, and it helps me know that I'm on the right track and I'm doing the right thing.
Can you describe for those who don't know what tactical medical is? Because I guess there are people who think that, you know, there are just doctors and other people who are trying to help in the hospitals or something like that. But what is specifically this tactical medical?
So we teach based on NATO and U.S. standards. It's called Tactical Combat Casualty Care, or TCCC. And there are multiple tiers or levels that fall under TCCC. We have all service members, which is the base level. Then there's CLS, which is Combat Lifesaver, CMC, which is Combat Corpsman, and CMP-CPP, which is Combat Paramedic. I am certified in a Combat Trauma Paramedic level, and that's one of the highest levels you can get. Essentially, what we teach, what I have helped teach, is Combat Lifesaver, which all soldiers should know, and Combat Corpsman. Combat Lifesaver basically covers how to properly put on a tourniquet when you're taking fire, also how to stop massive bleeding with hemostatic gauze. In addition to that, you also learn how to apply a chest seal and do a needle decompression if necessary. It teaches wound packing and splinting, all very important things that you need to know. The Combat Corpsman level is more advanced. This is where you start to learn how to do blood transfusions. It's also where you learn how to do drug administration. So the level, and also what is called a cricothyroidotomy, which is creating in a very advanced airway. So these are different levels. Combat Corpsman is more geared towards the, you know, unit or, you know, battalion medic that is specifically supposed to be like the main medic. CLS or Combat Lifesaver, like I said, that can be for, that should be taught to every soldier.
Do you keep track of how many people have you already trained, maybe, approximately?
Geez, approximately, it would probably be somewhere close to 200 at this point.
As I understand, there are different levels, but how long, I don't know, one of those or each of those trainings How long are they? Days, weeks for one person or for, I don't know, a group of person?
Unfortunately, because of the way the nature of the war, we can't do weeks. We basically, for CLS, it's about 5 days. For combat corpsmen, it's anywhere from 7 to 10 days. You know, if we could have longer, obviously it would be more preferable. But given the circumstances, you can't take longer for these classes. You just have to, you know, teach them as best as you can with the time limits that you're given and hope that you've managed to cover everything to the best of your ability, because time is precious.
And what would you say is the most difficult part of teaching this to others? And what have you noticed is the most difficult to them?
I think the most difficult thing is not having enough time. Wishing that, you know, all of us, myself, my other co-instructors, I think we all wish that we had more time to teach them. And, you know, more time to give them more scenarios and everything like that. It's just that we just don't have it. Time is one thing that we just don't have. I think that's the hardest part. And also just like giving them more reassurance, you know, that they have the tools they need if they ever are in that situation, that they have to use the knowledge that they've just gained. You know, that's the part that's hard, I think, is wishing that we had more time. I'm not sure like what's difficult for my students. I think maybe just like grappling with the fact that they may be in a situation where they would have to know how to do this and what would happen, you know, if they had, would they be able to do it if, you know, push came to shove. But, you know, obviously when you're in that situation, you will use the tools you have to save either yourself or your unit mate. So I think that's the hard part.
Yeah, do you see yourself doing this until the victory, or how do you see your, I don't know, next months, years, or?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm here for the long haul. You know, you don't go through like all of the work and the training that I've been doing to kind of like have like an end goal. Like there are people who are always, soldiers are always going to need to be trained. There are people who are always going to need help. And so until victory, that's how long I'll be here.
Have you also had to help to treat those who are injured as well? Maybe right from the coming right from the front, or after some time with some injuries, or it's mostly teaching the tactical?
Mostly teaching at this current moment. I will do some medic work soon, but you know, that's one thing also. I think for me, it's preparing for that eventuality, treating, you know, the injured as well, you know, and mentally preparing yourself for that. That's always, you know, one of those things where eventually it's going to be something that happens. And, you know, and that's also on me relying on all of the training that I've received and all of my education and certifications to know that I understand that I have the tools to do the job. So,
and you had maybe some scary moments, or when we were teaching, I don't know, shelling or something, because you told you do it all over the country. So I guess it's also near the front sometimes.
Well, the scary parts pretty much still happened when I was still delivering in logistics. We were helping on the rescue missions in Kherson during the floods. The closest I've ever been shelled was during that time when Russians were shelling volunteers trying to pull people out of the water. It was incredibly close. And that was probably, I think, the time that I was the most afraid. I've been, you know, living in the East for a while. And so, you know, we're kind of all used to air raids and you know, shelling in the distance. But nothing really prepares you for being shelled in close range. And I think that was probably the most frightening time for me, just because, you know, it's right up in front and you can't, you know, there's not many places to hide. So I would say that was maybe the most frightening. The other times I was in the East, further East, and delivering supplies. And, you know, at night you can hear drones that are hunting you from the Russian side because they fly in certain areas close to the front. So like, you know, you have to be very careful. Drones are not my favorite. We'll put it that way.
How do you think why other people from other countries would also like different kinds of specialties go to Ukraine, and some of them go to front to keep the Russians away, some of them delivering aid, you, for example, helping teaching this? Why do people from other countries do this, in your opinion? What is their motivation?
You know, I heard the other day that, you know, sometimes terrible situations like this will bring, the good people will become even better. And I think in that particular regard, that holds true for other people that are coming in from these other countries that may not 100% agree with helping in Ukraine. You know, it's about doing the right thing. And I think that's always going to be part of it. And I think that's why those people are here, because they believe in doing the right thing. And I would say that would be the best way I could answer that question, is that they believe, like I do, that it's the right thing to do it. You know, everybody makes sacrifices for the good to of others and to help them. And I think that those are the same type of people.
And what would you say to those maybe who, I don't know, listening to this, our conversation maybe, or, I don't know, following you on Twitter or know about you, who maybe also want to help somehow in Ukraine, or also maybe try to help in this way to teach something also? How hard it is, or how fast can you learn, and what are the obstacles maybe to do this, and why maybe should they also go to Ukraine and maybe do this? Yeah,
I think, you know, for one thing, it's always, it's a reminder that, you know, it's making the right sacrifices to come here for the right reasons. And if they want to help, I think that's wonderful. There's a great website called Volunteering in Ukraine, where people can sign up for different volunteering opportunities that, you know, would suit them. You know, if they want to teach and they have the certifications to do so as well, you know, that's another way of doing it. It's not, and also a reminder that it is a time commitment. I think that anybody who has less than a month to commit, it's not helpful in some ways, because, you know, now the need is for long-term help, not short-term. So, you know, that would be my one caveat, is to, you know, make sure that you have the time to commit to what you want to do in helping in Ukraine. All help is always welcome. That's never one thing that I want to make sure that that's very clear, is that all help is always welcome. But it is a time commitment to help here. You know, there are many different fundraisers all over Twitter all the time. So, you know, there's never a shortage of help in that regard. Also, spreading as much, you know, information about Ukraine as you can. You know, knowledge is power, making sure that people understand what is happening here, and also fighting disinformation. You know, there are many ways you can help in Ukraine and even outside of it.
And what will you say about how Ukrainians and Ukraine have changed in these years, in these months since you've been there? What have you noticed? I don't know, speaking with people and seeing everything that is around you.
Just in those discussions, you know, obviously morale is still high. People are still fighting. You know, they have motivation. They're fighting for their country, you know. But I think when anyone sees that, like, support is starting to dwindle, that can have an effect as well mentally. I mean, that's, you know, when you need help and it seems like people are starting to not want to give it, I think that would affect anyone. But Ukrainians are incredibly strong people and they keep fighting. I'm always impressed with their resilience and their strength, you know, to live in spite of the fact that someone is actively trying to kill you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I will have always immense respect for that, especially. So, you know, I mean, everybody is going to change. You know, war will change anyone. It's changed me. It's changed my friends that are here. Like, it just depends on how you choose to apply that change and, you know, the anger that, you know, you have, you know, put it towards a positive thing, which is to continue to work towards victory, I'd say.
The last question, I guess, we usually ask this to, I would say, almost everyone. What I can wish to you personally, of course, everyone wishes victory and peace, but specifically for you, what can I wish to you?
Oh, you know, I think always just like, well wishes are the best wishes, you know, wishing someone good health and good strength. We could use all the strength we could get. So, you know, that's always energy to keep going, which of course, you know, never ends, but some days it's, you know, a little bit, there's more coffee involved than others.
Okay, well, then I wish to you many cup of strong coffee.
Perfect.
And good health and lots of energy and lots of saved lives from your work. That will be great, I guess, yeah.
Henry Hards, I appreciate it very much. And, you know, if I could impart just a few, like last few words.
Yeah, sure.
Anyone can do anything they set their mind to with the right intentions and the right dedication to everything. I think that when your heart is good and you want to work hard and you want to help people, you can do anything. And I think that's part of what drives me as well, is the need to help here and do as much good as you can. You know, that's very important. And I'm very proud of the work that, you know, Blue Yellow USA and other NGOs have done here, and that, you know, the teaching with TACMED, very proud of it, because it does create a visible impact. So I would just say that if you want to help and you can, there's a way. So thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for this conversation. I hope there will be more and more help going to Ukraine, and not only in terms of some deliveries, humanitarian and so on, but also human resources and knowledge and things like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rihards. I appreciate it.
Paldies, tas bija Rihards Plūmē sarunā ar Rimu Žuraitis, Amerikas lietuvieti Ukrainā. Man interesants šķita tas aspekts, par ko viņi runā, ja kāds no mūsu klausītājiem gribētu doties uz Ukrainu, dot kaut kādu savu artavu, ka vismaz tajā jomā, ko viņa dara, tur nedar tāds atskrēju uz nedēļu skrien projām. Un tas ir svarīgi un tas ir jāņem vērā. Tāpat laikā ir veidi, kur arī, piemēram, ja tu ir tava atvaļinājuma nedēļa un tu gribētu kaut kā dot to savu artavu, tad arī tik īsā laikā tas ir iespējams. Atcerieties, mums drošinātājā ir bijusi, piemēram, saruna ar Ditu Krauzi, kura dzīvo Londonā, bet dodās uz Lvivu palīdzēt virtuvē, kas sagatavo ēdienu Ukrainas karavīriem. Redzēja, ka pusgadu vēlāk pēc mūsu intervijas, kas klausāma arī drošinātāja arhīvā, viņa atkal bija aizbraukusi uz Ukrainu, arī uz salīdzinošu neilgu laiku, bet tā kā vienkārši, ja vien ir vēlme, iespēja atradīsies. Savukārt atceramies, ka Latvija te Sarmī Cīrule Ukrainā vēl aiz vienu dienu, viņa ir kaujas mediķi un saņēmusi ordeņus gan no Ukrainas, gan Latvijas, tā kā sveiciens arī Sarmītei. Galvenais, novēlam jums drošību, atgriešanos mājās pēc tam, kad karš būs beidzies un uzvara būs gūta.
Jā, un novēlam arī enerģiju, ko Rima arī vēstīja, ka nu diezgan daudz kafijas tās aiziet ikdienā, enerģija ir nepieciešama, gan mācot dažreiz pat tajā pašā Twitterī cilvēkiem sniedzot padomus par taktisko medicīnu ar to saistītām lietām, gan arī, protams, nu, realitātē strādājot ar cilvēkiem. Un, nu jā, bet nevienmēr šie stāsti varbūt ir tik ļoti pozitīvi, protams, daudz dzīvību sanāk glābt, bet arī neilgi pēc intervijas arī šajā pašā sociālajā tīklā manī, ka, nu, diemžēl arī viens no viņas apmācāmajiem karavīriem, ko viņa vēl nesen bija apmācījusi taktiskajā medicīnā, arī, diemžēl, frontē gājas bojā, tā kā, nu, viņa saņem atgriezenisko saiti par to, kas notiek ar tiem, kurus viņa ir apmācījusi, un, protams, ka, nu, karš, kā mēs zinām, ir nežēlīgs un ne visi, diemžēl, protams, izdzīvo. Taiskaitā arī tos, kurus Rīma Ukrainā apmāca, bet nu, viņi ir apņēmības pilni turpināt savu darbu līdz uzvarai.
Savukārt, ja jums, drošinātāji klausītāji, ir vēlme dzirdēt kādas konkrētas profesijas pārstāvi kādā no mūsu nākamajām epizodēm, tad rakstiet mums uz drošinātājs at Latvijas Radio LV, mēģināsim sadzīt rokās. Esam aptvēruši jau gan lielu spektru cilvēku un tiecamies šo spektru arvien paplašināt. Tā kā, ja jums ir kādas idejas, rakstiet mums, atcerieties, katra jauna epizode iznāk ceturtdienās, un ja jūs klausāties mūsu ierakstā, tad varat vienkārši paspies podziņu un klausīties jau nākamo epizodu, jo šī ir nonākusi līdz loģiskām beigām.
Jā, tādēļ laiks mums no jums atvadīties, lai jau tiktos pavisam drīz nākamajā epizodē ar jauniem tematiem, jaunu ekspertīzi un visu citu. Un atcerieties, drošinātājs, tas ir skaidri un personīgi par karu Ukrainā.
Raidieraksts drošinātājs.